N. Balarama Reddy's first meeting with the Maharishi. On a sunny South Indian morning in the month of March in 1933, I first walked into Sri Ramanashramam. It was just before breakfast, and I was immediately welcomed and led into the dining room. Of course, the dining hall wasn't the large structure we see now, but a single room thatched building just south of the old hall, which also served by turns as the kitchen, office, and the Maharishi's bathroom. I was asked to sit behind a certain leaf plate. Other visitors and inmates were seating themselves, some behind a wall panel, the Brahmins, and others near me. To my surprise, I found myself seated immediately next to the Maharishi on his right. I felt blessed and fortunate to be given this seat and looked on the whole scene, wondering at the intimacy and informality of it all. But what I felt most amidst the quiet and orderly movements of the ashramites was the penetrating silence of the atmosphere. A deep, penetrating silence seemed to be pushing my mind deeper and deeper into my inner being. The food was served, and the Maharishi turned his head to the right and nodded, a gesture indicating that we should begin eating. That nod or gesture had the effect of prompting my mind to sink even deeper into silence. Meals finished, I went and sat in the hall and waited for the Maharishi to return. He generally went out for walks after rising early in the morning, after his noon meal, and at 5 p.m. I had read and heard from others that he rarely put questions to visitors. Therefore, I was not disappointed when he returned to the hall, sat and remained silent. I also did not feel like asking questions or breaking the silence with words. At 11 a.m., I was called for lunch. Once more, I witnessed the same intimacy, informality, quiet orderliness, and the nod from the Maharishi to begin eating. After lunch, I once again returned to the hall. About 1 p.m., an old and long-standing devotee of Maharishi arrived at the ashrama from some distant place. He walked into the old hall, saluted the master, and lay down on the floor near Bhagavan's couch. Within moments, he fell sound asleep. I sat wondering, this Maharishi is accessible at all hours. His presence evokes a deep inner stillness. Everything is so serene, natural, and informal. I concluded that there was something here clearly unique. At 5 p.m., I had to leave to catch the train back to Pondicherry. I stood up and approached the Maharishi to take leave. He asked me where I had come from. I told him, and since he had on his own began talking with me, inquired of him if I could ask a couple of questions. Yes, of course, he said. Now, after the passing of 60 years, I can recall only one of the two questions I first asked him. I said, there is a teacher and his disciples. The teacher gives the same instruction to all the disciples sitting before him. How is it that some disciples hear the teachings, put them into practice, and make fast progress, while others hear and apply the same teachings and make little or no progress? The Maharishi replied, some must have followed that line of teaching in their previous lives, while others may have just begun. Also, some are born more advanced and fit than others. That was my first visit to the Maharishi in 1933, when I was 24 and a half years old, and Although that visit made a deep impression on me, I didn't arrange to go back until 2 years later. I now believe that during those 2 years, the Maharishi's force was silently working. I now believe that during those 2 years, the Maharishi's force was silently working on me from within, without my being aware of it. Bhagavan, as we usually call the Maharishi, often quoted this stanza of Saint Thayiman verse in praise of the Guru. Oh Lord, coming with me all along the birds, never abandoning me, and finally rescuing me. I find this stanza truly reflects the way I feel about Bhagavan. Early life. I cannot say anything about my previous births, but in this birth, I have been spiritually inclined since my childhood. You could say it is because of the legacy passed down to me from my father and my own inherited tendencies. My father was a serious sadhaka. He practiced austerities in his youth, studied the scriptures, and even observed mauna, silence, for 1 year. He also went on a pilgrimage to the holy places in North India, visiting ashrams and sacred shrines in the Himalayas. After this pilgrimage, he decided to take up the life of a grihastha, a householder. But in spite of marrying, having a secular occupation and raising a family, my father always cherished spiritual ideals. A life centered on God as the ideal was the essential element of our daily life in my father's house. I was born on 30th of October 1908. For my birth, my father was eager that I should imbibe spiritual values, and he was very concerned that secular studies might smother my spiritual inclination. In my teens, I was inspired by the life and ideals of Mahatma Gandhi. I regularly read his monthly magazine, Young India, and molded my life accordingly. Gandhi introduced the Salt Satyagraha in 1930, and this caused a great stir throughout the country. I was then a postgraduate student at the Hindu University in Banaras. Later, during the summer break, when I was at my home in Andhra Pradesh, the police arrested the president of our Nellore District Congress Committee. The committee met and decided to ask me to take over the position of the president. I accepted, and when this fact was published in the newspapers, the police wasted no time in arresting me. For 4 months, I remained incarcerated. At that time, I had an idealistic view of politics, Mahatma Gandhi's goals, and the volunteers who worked to achieve them. I was under the impression that all those selfless workers arrested in the freedom struggle were naturally endowed with saintly characteristics, much like their leader, Gandhiji. In prison, I had a disappointing awakening to the real nature of many of these jailed nationalists. I soon became disenchanted with the ideal of political activity for attaining freedom, especially when I arrived at the understanding that spiritual freedom or self-realization was the highest goal of life and political freedom would not actually change us spiritually. When I was studying in the Banaras University, the life and teachings of Sri Ramakrishna also exerted considerable influence on my spiritual ideals. By the time I was in the middle of an MA degree in Banaras, I began to seriously question the use of all these degrees in the light of an ever-deepening desire to follow wholeheartedly a spiritual path. I concluded that the purpose of life was not to attain material goals, but rather to realize God and experience the truth of a universal underlying reality. When this conviction became firm, I decided to leave the university and dedicate my life to the spiritual ideal. In all the scriptures, I read that a guru was necessary to guide one on the spiritual path. I thought that I should also find a guru to lead me to liberation. In search of one, I first traveled to North India, visiting all the celebrated saints and yogis. I would spend some days or weeks at their ashrams and then move on to the next one. Throughout this trip, I was unable to find any teacher that captivated my heart and mind to the extent that I could honestly surrender myself as a disciple. I remember being asked by the disciples of the leader of Radha Swami movement to take the initiation from the Guru. I had been residing at their center for 3 days. I expressed my disinclination, stating that I did not believe the time had come for me to choose a Guru. When this information was passed on to the head of the ashrama, he entirely agreed with me, saying that it had taken him 20 years to choose a guru. Aurobindo Ashrama. In 1931, after reading about Sri Aurobindo and also hearing about him from others, I made my way to his ashrama in Pondicherry. Immediately upon my arrival, I was struck by the spiritual atmosphere of the place. On 15th of August of that year, I had my first darshan of Sri Aurobindo. This was one of 3 times in a year that he gave darshan. I found Sri Aurobindo and mother to be powerful spiritual personalities, as they seemed to have the ability to work on the development of the disciples in a silent and invisible manner. All of Aurobindo's philosophical writings cannot convey his or the mother's power as spiritual embodiments. In his ashrama, I pursued the same spiritual ideals that I had already formulated. I was required to do 2 hours of work every day and selected garden work from the options available. We would daily have darshan of the mother and sit before her in meditation. But since the mother's schedule would sometimes fluctuate, this routine varied at times. Generally, we were left to ourselves to study Aurobindo's writings and pursue our spiritual practices. Although we normally had to take permission of the mother when doing anything out of the ordinary. At the 3 annual darshans, mother and Aurobindo would sit side by side on a couch, and we would approach them one by one and touch their feet. I made it a practice not to miss any of these darshans and would sometimes visit my village between these events. In my village, I lived in a hut built in a garden about 200 meters from the main house. Whenever I resided there, my family regularly set me food and gave me freedom to pursue my sadhana in solitude. In this manner, traveling between Pondicherry and my village, I earnestly was engaged in spiritual practice year round. Second visit to Sri Ramanashramam. While I was in Aurobindo Ashrama, I met Kapali Sastriyar, the esteemed disciple of both Aurobindo and Ganapati Muni. As he was now and then visiting Sri Ramanashramam, he would describe to me the Maharishi and his ashrama. His intriguing descriptions, along with the reading of B.V. Narasimha Swami's biography of the Maharishi, is what prompted my first visit to Ramanashramam in 1933. When I visited Sri Ramanashramam the second time in March of 1935, I decided to make it a 3-day visit. In those days, there was no bus transportation between Pondicherry and Thiruvannamalai, and travelers had to go by train. I boarded the train at Pondicherry at 9 p.m., got down in Viluppuram Junction, and then waited a few hours before catching the train to Thiruvannamalai. Though The total distance to travel was only 65 miles. The whole trip took me 9 hours. I arrived in Tiruvannamalai at 6 a.m., made my way to the ashrama, and was provided accommodations in a small room next to the well. Soon after my arrival, I saw Yogi Ramaya. He was a close disciple of the Maharishi, whom Paul Brunton wrote about in his book, A Search in Sacred India. Yogi Ramaya, being from the same area of Andhra Pradesh that I was from, somehow immediately recognized me. He took me to Bhagavan and formally introduced me to him. Though the yogi was then observing silence, with him gesturing and me filling in the words, we were able to convey to Bhagavan our connection. I later discovered that Yogi Ramaya knew my father very well and had even stayed overnight at my family's house on some occasion. Before this second visit to Ramanashramam, I once again read Bhagavan's biography. In it, I found a passage relating to the possibility of changing one's guru. I had a doubt about this and addressed it to the Maharishi. He told me, yes, certainly, one can change his guru. What of that? In Arabindo Ashrama, our daily life, to a large extent, was regulated and controlled. For instance, even to take a simple trip into town, we had to obtain permission. In contrast, here in Ramanashramam, it was totally different. I experienced a liberating feeling of freedom, informality, and spontaneity. Everything was so natural and at the same time elevating. Also, in Aurobindo Ashrama, disciples were generally permitted to visit all other saints and ashramas, with the exception of the Maharishi and Sri Ramanashramam. It was believed that the Maharishi had the power to undo years of spiritual preparation that the mother and Aurobindo were effecting on the psyche of the followers. In other words, they considered the Maharishi too powerful an influence. Bhagavan was aware of this, and once when I was alone with him, he told me, yes, I know of that place. They are afraid of me. On this second visit, I would sit daily in the Maharishi's serene presence. I was again struck by his deep, penetrating silence. I lost all interest in everything but the Maharishi and his presence. I somehow felt, by merely sitting near him, all my aspirations could be fulfilled. At the end of this 3-day visit, I began to feel that perhaps my place was there with the Maharishi. The idea of having Bhagavan as my guru and Ramanashramam as my home began revolving in my mind. Taking leave of the Maharishi, I approached him while he was sitting on his couch, which was then positioned outside on the veranda. His feet were softly resting on the ground. He had just returned from an afternoon stroll following the midday meal. I fell to my knees and bowed before his holy feet. I was aware of the ashrama rule that prohibited devotees from touching Bhagavan's body, so I kept a slight distance. But as I lowered my head near his feet, in the twinkling of an eye, Bhagavan's feet ever so gently raised from the ground, and the large toe of each foot somehow very lightly touched the closed eyelids of each of my eyes. It happened all in an instant. No one even noticed. I was thrilled. Continued in the May-June issue.